Lewis J. Williams, a native of New Orleans, but a resident of Chattanooga for more than half of his long and productive life, played a large role in the community's business and civic life over half a century. He moved here in 1934 as a sales executive for a cement company, and later served for a decade as the vice president of one of the major banks. His major field of interest, however, and the one with which he is most widely identified, is that of conservation. He was a founder of the Tennessee Conservation League, which led a successful battle for a model fish and game law, and of Keep Tennessee Green, which sponsored major efforts in reforestation. He was a president of the Chamber of Commerce and of the Kiwanis Club, among other activities. The interview with him was recorded June 1st, 1983, just 3 weeks before his 91st birthday, at his home on Windsor Court by Norman Bradley for the Chattanooga Hamilton County Bicentennial Library's Oral History Project. Well, Mr. Williams, just to sort of set the scene, you are a native of New Orleans.
Correct.
Did you grow up there?
I lived there until I was about 16. Mm-hmm. Then I moved to Jackson, Mississippi.
Were you at what age?
When I went to Jackson?
Yeah.
I was about 16.
Were you on your own then?
Oh, yeah.
Working for yourself?
Right. I went to work for... I was in the typewriter business. I mean, as a typewriter mechanic, which was almost my first job, my second job. My first one was an office boy with the Duffy Trunk Company. And then after, I was then about 12 or 13 years old, and then after about 3 years repairing typewriters and so forth, I had an opportunity to go to Jackson with a company there that was in the typewriter business and wanted someone knowledgeable in typewriter mechanics and so forth.
Did you stay in the typewriter business very long?
Yeah, I'd say roughly maybe 20 years or so.
As a mechanical mechanic or?
See, I married in 1912, living in Kansas City, which was my wife's home. And they promoted me we married in about the middle of December, and they promoted, and I had a 2 weeks off. And then when I went back, they promoted me to a position of salesman and moved me to Springfield, Missouri, where my wife and I took up residence. And I went on and bounced back and forth with two different typewriter companies, Remington and Underwood. Although I'd started with L.C. Smith, living in New Orleans and in Shreveport, Louisiana, and Dallas, Texas. And finally, I wanted to be with the company, with a branch office of the company. And I wrote to several of the branches of the L.C. Smith Company and made a connection with them in Kansas City. I was still then kind of an outside repairman, handling maybe about 15 calls a day from people who had trouble with their typewriter. And the First National Bank there had 40 or 50 of our machines, and that's how I met my wife. She was a secretary, and I took care of that typewriter better than any typewriter in Kansas City.
When did you ever become connected with a branch, with a...
Oh, yeah, at Kansas City.
That was a
branch office of the L.C. Smith and Brother Typewriter Company.
And then, from then on, how long did you stay with Smith after that?
Well, I stayed with them for several years. And then I moved around. I traveled in Mississippi and in Louisiana and so on. And then I took up doing typewriter repair work on my own. And I would spend 3 or 4 days in each town where I stopped. And that was a little bit before I went with the company at Kansas City. And finally, when I gave up that is when I wrote to the several branch offices and got connected with Kansas City.
When did you, one of your major connections in the business world, of course, was with a cement company. How did that come about?
Well, I went, the Atlas Cement Company bought a plant out in Leeds, Alabama, 18 miles from Birmingham. And when they opened the office there at Birmingham, my job I was then sales manager for the typewriter company, was to sell them some typewriters. And I made the acquaintance of the office manager, Charles Postel, who just recently died. And he said, "You ought to be in the cement business." Well, I said, "I'm willing to listen." And he said, "The vice president of our company will be here Wednesday," which this was about Monday. And I said, I'll give you my itinerary, and you call me when he comes, and I'll come in and talk to him," which I did. His name was MacFarlane. And I went then into the cement business.
Was it salesmanship that attracted you? Was that your central interest?
Oh yeah, that was it. When I came here on the 1st of January 1934. TVA was just about 6 months old. And they, at that time, were buying cement for Norris Dam. And of course, the potential of the cement business with TVA's future program was just almost out of bounds, in other words. So the first cement bought by TVA was bought from the presidents of the several companies in the competitive area by the one of the three members of the TVA board. Well, I was a small fry compared with the presidents, you know what I mean. So I didn't get into the selling of cement to TVA until a year or two later. But finally, I became very friendly with Dave Lilienthal and the two Morgans, which comprised the board then, and then later with Gordon Clapp. And with Red Wagner. So that was my cement career as far as TVA is concerned, see?
Most of the buying was through an office here, wasn't it? In Chattanooga, or was it in Knoxville?
No, it was in Knoxville.
Knoxville.
Yeah. See, they were buying then for really only for Norris Dam.
Norris.
But later, of course, when they built the several other dams, not only on the main stream, but on the tributaries.
Yeah.
And I was in the office here as assistant sales manager and caught most of the telephone calls. So I got acquainted with a lot of the TVA people, didn't even know them. I just knew them by telephone, see.
This was a, what cement company was this?
This was
what was your
Universal Atlas then.
Universal Atlas.
Yeah.
Later became...
Well, it was, you see, it was originally the Atlas Cement Company.
Yeah.
And then Universal Cement Company, which was a branch of the United States Steel Corporation, took over Atlas.
Well, you also, there was a good deal of building going on here in Chattanooga.
Oh, not only here, but you see, we did a terrific business in Florida. Our mill, we had a mill down in near Perry, Georgia, and one out here in Richard City, Tennessee. And I made any number of trips to Florida where everybody was building something. And of course, this was about the time when states like Louisiana, Mississippi, North Carolina, Georgia were right in the midst of their highway building program. And there would be a highway letting at Raleigh, North Carolina today that might have involved 300,000 or 400,000 barrels of cement. And the next day I'd be at Baton Rouge where they were holding another letting with about the same quantity of cement, maybe more, maybe a little less. So I just, at that stage of the game, I was a special representative and just handled the big lettings and some of the disgruntled people that we had to deal with, you know, people that were dissatisfied and so on and so on. So my job was to keep them happy and keep them using our cement.
You had to be a salesman of a lot of things.
That's right.
Of satisfaction as well as cement. Then, did you remain as long as you were in the cement business? What was that your primary job? Salesmanship.
That's right. That's
you never were in the manufacturing.
No. But I was in sales management. Our company, for instance, when I was in Kansas City, our company built a new plant down at Waco, Texas. And I commuted between Kansas City and Waco. I had to select the office space, hire the salesman, buy the automobiles and other things to equip the offices and all of that, see? So I spent a good deal of time between Kansas City and Waco. I remember in Waco one time in the Hilton Hotel, which was the first multi-story Hilton, I went in there for breakfast one morning and I had never seen up to then a pink red grapefruit. So I ordered a half a grapefruit and an ordinary breakfast, you know. And the waiter brought the grapefruit in with a cherry in the center of it. And I said, "Waiter, take this grapefruit back. That cherry's been in here so long it's discolored the grapefruit." See? He laughed and and said, Captain, you ain't never seen a real grand red grapefruit? I said, no, I never have. He said, you eat this and you'll sure be glad you did. So that was the first red grapefruit I saw.
Well, after you came to Chattanooga in 34, were you here? Was this just a headquarters, more or less, and you traveled a great deal, or did you spend a great deal of time here?
At first, this was the Dixie Portland Cement Company, the headquarters. Mr. Hardy was the president of the company, had been mayor of Chattanooga and all that. It was definitely a Chattanooga concern.
Yes.
And then, of course, when...
His name was...
Richard Hardy.
Richard Hardy,
yeah.
Yes, okay.
To answer the question that you just raised, most of the time I was at first here in the office as assistant sales manager, but later, of course, did a lot of traveling.
Did you begin to make friends from your business connections here? Or through your interest in civic affairs or outdoors, sports, or whatever?
Well, Norman, in several other cities that I had lived in, I felt like that I ought to do something to pay for the space I took up. And I got interested as early as 1918 in Shreveport, when I became a charter member of the Shreveport Lions Club. And then there was a very active other club there called the Shreveport Ad Club, and I joined it. I was still selling typewriters then. And so when I moved to Kansas City, where I lived twice, the last time I was sales manager of the Atlas Portland Cement Company of Kansas, which was a subsidiary of the, and I worked at that, hired the salesman and worked with them, go out and make trips with them and so on and so on. But I took a special interest in the Chamber of Commerce. And then when I moved back for the second time to Birmingham, I took, again, a special interest in the Chamber of Commerce. And of course, when I moved here, I had in Birmingham had been so active in the Boy Scouts, the Boys Club, and in my church, and in other activities, that when I came here, I took a sabbatical, and I didn't go into anything civic, except, of course, join the church. And then after a while, Dr. Fowle, who was my preacher, talked to me.
This was the First Presbyterian Church.
That's right. Yeah. And where he'd been pastor for many years. And he talked me into going into the Boy Scouts, which I told him I was already familiar with and all. And I tried to duck it as best I could, but he won, as he always did.
You don't duck, you didn't duck, foul, did you?
So I went on the board of the Boy Scouts here. And was, of course, real active. And in fact, in 2-3 years, I was president of the council. But I had my interest in scouting went back to Kansas City when my only child, my only son, was about 12 years old and was a scout, see? So that was where I made quite a number of local friends there, and I didn't have much of an opportunity other than a few little civic activities while I was here with the cement company to make friends, you see.
Yeah.
And of course later, several years later, when I went into banking after retiring from business, it was then my job to make friends. I was in public relations then, you see. And not too long ago, before I say that, let me say that I made a lot of speeches on scouting and conservation and one or two other special subjects. And I always wrote those speeches out. Always. I always felt that any time anyone asked me to make a speech, they were entitled to the very best I could do. I wasn't always successful with that, but at the same time, and then I transferred that on 3x5 cards, which I could hold in my hand. Seldom ever used them, but that was my way of doing it. And upstairs here in my office or den, I've got all of those cards.
You kept them.
I kept them, and they were invaluable to me later when I would receive, as I did not too frequently, a second invitation. 3 or 4 years later, I was able to impress them by saying, you know, it's the last time I was here was May the 15th, back 4 or 5 years ago. Man, I'd give them the date and all that, see.
And I told you this.
That's right. Yeah, that was helpful because I didn't have to repeat, you know.
Yes.
So I got...
Didn't you interest in I can understand your interest in scouting through your son, family, and your... what about conservation, a broader area of interest? What prompted that?
Well, Grover Rand was writing a hunting and fishing column for the Times, and he had an ailment that the doctors felt he ought to be less active while he was over at the what's the name of the original, we used to call it consumption?
Oh, TB, oh.
TB hospital.
Yeah.
He was over there for quite a while. And I had written a series of columns for him on how to make a fishing rod with my own drawings, so on and so on. And so when he got to that point, he asked me if I'd take over that column.
What business was he in?
I don't remember, but he was from McDonald, Tennessee, here near Cleveland.
Yeah.
Okay. And was very active, but I can't remember what business he was in. So I took the column over, and shortly after one of the predecessors on the Times of this column before Rand, I've forgotten his name, but he was still getting bulletins from the Outdoor Writers Association. So I joined the Outdoor Writers Association. And of course, that was all conservation. I mean, you see. And so along about 1942, and I'd been writing the column for about a year, I called a meeting here at the Reed House on February 12th and organized the Tennessee Conservation League with 15 charter members scattered from Memphis to Kingsport and so on, Knoxville, Nashville, Chattanooga.
Excuse me just a minute, Lou. Had you, at this point, had you actually succeeded Grover in writing the column? Had he dropped it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You had picked it
that's
up.
That's right.
And you were outdoor.
I succeeded editor. Him, in other words.
Yes.
Outdoor editor, that's
outdoor
right.
Outdoor editor, yeah. Chattanooga Times. And this would have been in 41 or 42.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
I wrote that column from, I think, from 41 to about 48,
yeah.
Somewhere along in
yeah.
there. Well, after being getting acquainted with the Outdoor Writers Association of America, which in two or three years I'd become chairman of the board, I wanted to organize a Tennessee Outdoor Writers. Well, the state conservation department had just acquired a sizable piece of land up here near Crossville called the Cumberland State Forest. And they invited the outdoor writers, the newspaper people and so on to this meeting where they were going to dedicate this property. And I figured this was a fine opportunity to organize the Tennessee Writers because a good number of them would be there. And which we did that. And I was elected president and served in that capacity for, I guess, 3, 4, 5 years. Incidentally, that is still going.
Yes.
Now, this was long in 42 or something, 43, long in there, and of course the world of our fishermen and hunters were out in the Pacific. And I wanted the Tennessee Outdoor Writers Association to be the core or the nucleus of a statewide organization of sportsmen. And that was the way I wanted or tried to get the support of all of the outdoor writers throughout Tennessee so that the Tennessee Conservation League, which was formed later, would have their support. And incidentally, that organization is still going. I was able to get a gift of $100,000 from a Memphis newspaper man.
That Mr. Meeman?
Yeah, Meeman. Ed Meeman.
Ed Meeman, who was added to the Memphis Press Center.
At that time, later, he became the conservation editor of all the Scripps Hired Papers.
Yes, later, when he retired.
Later, see, yeah. That's right. And, but I took the precaution to say that in order to get that money, we ought to be required to raise a similar sum ourselves over a period of 5 years. And I'd been trying to raise money for them, you know, for years and years and years. Well, we finally did that. So the organization now is well financed, just like the Chattanooga Audubon Society is well
yeah.
financed.
Yeah.
You see, I mean, I had to try. I was president for 9 years of that group, and still feel like I'm part of it. When we got a gift of some about $150,000. From a man that used to live here, Roberts, you remember him in the Kiwanis
yes.
Club.
Yes.
he was a radio ham, and I had two grandsons that were radio hams, and he wanted to use the sanctuary for their annual all-night program. I told him, go ahead and use it. I mean, we was delighted to have him use it. So he told me later how much he appreciated it, and he said, I'm going to see that Audubon gets something from my will. Well, I thought maybe $500 or $1,000, something like that. But in the meantime, they had no children. He and his wife retired, and he and his wife moved to Florida and bought some property down there, and they were living there, and she died. So he really had no one else to leave the property to. So he left approximately $160,000 to the Audubon Society, clear of all debts. In other words, he paid the attorneys, he paid for the handling of the transfers of the property and all of that, see?
Lou, didn't he do this, make all the arrangements and take care of everything himself before he died? But wasn't he here at the time? Didn't he come here to do all of the preliminary work?
Not that I know of. He may have. I don't know that. But he was with the, he was a salesman for...
His name was...
I've forgotten his first name. His name was Roberts, anyhow.
Roberts.
See, we had a couple of Roberts, Nathan Roberts in the Kiwanis Club, too, you know. But anyway, he was with one of the big companies that made cement manufacturing equipment.
Right.
Yeah, the kilns and all of that.
Things come full circle.
Yeah.
Well, to get back to the conservation movement and the Conservation League, after you had become a member of the National Outdoor Writers Association and you helped form and was president of the Tennessee Outdoor Writers Association, then you formed, took the leadership in forming the Tennessee Conservation League. Now, what was the situation in the state which prompted the League's interest in and battle for a better conservation law, game and fish law? Tell us about that.
Well, in the first place, the Game and Fish Division of the Tennessee Conservation Department was almost totally financed from the sale of game, hunting, and fishing licenses. The only other money they got was from federal aid that came, was apportioned to the states from excise taxes on sporting goods, arms, ammunition, fish and tackle, and so on, see? So,
excuse me, now let's set the time for this. About, would you characterize it as being in the 40s and 50s?
Yeah, I would say maybe the late 40s, early 50s.
All right, great.
And the first thing we did, this was about 1942, was to set up a committee to draft a model game and fish administrative organization. And Carl Steinmetz, a good lawyer friend of mine from Knoxville, was made chairman of the committee, and he contacted any number of states. We had about six or eight meetings scattered, one time at Athens, one time at Kingsport, and so on. And we came up finally with this model game and fish law. In the meantime, Governor Browning, I mean, he was a candidate for his second term. And he had set up in his first term around 1937 the Conservation Department. Well, we wanted to take game and fish out of the Conservation Department. And it's only there that Ed Maiman and I disagreed. We worked together lots by telephone, by correspondence, and all of that. He didn't want to separate the game and fish. But we finally did it. I took the draft of the bill up to the Patton Hotel to see Governor, candidate Governor, Browning, who was a candidate for governor. And after some detailed explanation of what we hoped to do and all of that, he said, "Lou, you will be satisfied with what I say about this program in my a plank in my platform," which he had not yet made public, see. And he just went overboard for it. And that was back in the day when you just couldn't get a bill through the legislature unless the governor approved it. We won this thing with one opposing vote in the Senate, two opposing votes in the House. And I still don't know why, what we did wrong to lose those three votes. But Browning finally, a spokesman for Browning, finally gave us credit for 80,000 of his votes. Now, I don't know how on earth they figured that, but we were willing to take the credit for it since it came from them, see.
Who were the opponents? It didn't show up in the legislative vote, but there was strong opposition to the idea at the grassroots level, I'm sure. Who did not want it passed?
Oh, a good part of the legislature.
Yeah, well, what was the basis?
It passed. And then when we set the program up, every 2 years we had to fight to keep it. And after it passed, I got letters from five or six different states. And I went into detail in answering it of what we did to change the whole setup. And it, incidentally, is, with a few modifications, is still the program practically that we set up at the time.
Why were people against it?
There were a lot of political rewards that weren't present in the new program. I mean, the game wardens didn't do any game protecting.
The old
game wardens. They were busy on election day, you know, and the governors had appointed some people who were defeated candidates and other political riffraff. To the top jobs of game and fish director and conservation director and all of that, see?
They, as I understand it, they had no game and fish commission. That was created by the Act.
That's right.
The Game and Fish Commission. And under the new law, the Game and Fish Commission then appointed the game wardens and the counties of the localities.
Yeah, and they did it on the basis of merit.
Of merit and training.
That's right.
Before then, if I understand it correctly, the local game wardens were pretty much political hangers-on.
No question about it.
Appointed by the, got the jobs through political favoritism.
Judge Cummins got several of them jobs. He practically appointed them.
Whoever was a local political power got the appointment for who he wanted from
that's
the
right,
state.
That's right.
I see. As far as you know, well, there's a number of states which followed along with this type of.
Pennsylvania had two commissions. Commission, a fish commission and a game commission. And any number of states had programs that were far in excellency, either ahead of our new program or mm-hmm. about to par with it, see? The first thing that we did when the new commission came in, Lucius Birch of Memphis was chairman. He asked me to name a five-man committee to go over the present program in Tennessee and see how it could be improved. And I appointed Ira Gabrielson, who was the head of the Wildlife Management Institute. I appointed the Missouri chairman, I've forgotten his name, and Texas. Then I appointed a couple of people here, Charlie Dunn, who was out at Fort Oglethorpe, and Bill Paddock, who was the head of the Cherokee Forest. I felt like they could furnish some local color and so on. And they came up with this program, and the commission adopted it. They didn't hire anybody. In other words, for the first time, we were hiring ichthyologists, foresters, game and fish management personnel, and so forth, that had training and had spent some years in college getting the know-how. Instead of just appointing some political has-been, we were hiring real people who could really. The first director of Game and Fish that the commission employed was, I can't think of the name right at the moment, but he was assistant director of North Carolina.
So the upshot of it was that we got into the state, began to get into the state and to build on that base, qualified people.
That's right. That's right.
As far as you know, that program is still pretty much intact with refinements here.
That's right. That's right. And there's no more opposition. Mm-hmm. I mean, every now and then some member of the legislature from a small county wants to pass a law on coon hunting or some such thing as that that's applicable only in his county. Well, we were plagued with that over a period of years. Each member of the legislature had a little pet bill he wanted to get through, and you couldn't tell. We had no national, statewide program at all, see? So
How long did that, what period of years did that take, Lou, before when you first began to get interested in it or committed to it?
Well,
until it was finally.
We started in about 1942, and the victory convention of the league was in either 1949 or 1950.
roughly 10 years.
Yeah.
Well, that interest for you had some offshoots. You got, I don't know when, but it certainly added to your interest in, woods and in woodworking, fishing rods. Tell me about some of your work with fishing rods and where they've all gone.
Well, I started fooling with the fishing rods out of my knowledge of